Hey everybody, before we get started, I need to let you know that this is part two of our two-part Yellow Jackets Spectacular. If you have not yet listened to part one, we recommend that you hop back one episode in your feed and do so now. If you already have, then buckle up for part two of our conversation, already in progress. Yeah, and so, I mean, that's one of my, and jump back to in a second as well, at the end is like, well, how many people actually did survive? Because yeah. Jessica, the reporter slash, private eye fixer, the way she talks about, you know, generally speaking, in air quotes, you guys are this, you guys are that, you don't want to be found, you live off the grid. Mm-hmm. It makes it seem like core four, and spend a lot of time with, are not the most of the people. Like, it seems like there's at least 8 or 10 that maybe made it. It's just my reaction to her dialogue.
Well, definitely some of you guys live off the grid. I took that, especially later when we found out after Misty has kidnapped her.
Yeah.
We find out that she did speak to Travis before he died. So she definitely found Travis, who changed his name and clearly lives off the grid. So I took that, I took her to be referring to him in retrospect.
Yeah.
Also, just a fun moment in episode 7 is so there we flash back and forth between present day and past in the woods, and there. So it's 7 is the episode where Thaisa leads a little group of about 4 girls to try to find help.
They're gonna
walk off and try to find help, and they're sitting around the campfire before they go to sleep. And Van is telling everyone the story of the movie While You Were Sleeping.
Yes,
which did come out so in 1995. Uh-huh. So I checked that, and it was like, oh, was that, that feels right that they would have seen, but because I know there are some anachronisms, so I checked, it did come out in 95, and she's telling that story, and then we go to the present, and Misty, who has trapped
such a
Jessica
great,
Roberts in great, her oh basement gosh. Is showing her While You Were Sleeping, and I just had this moment of like, she should be showing her misery because she's pulling a Kathy Bates right now. And basically, I don't know what your misery was, but I think it's long enough ago that that would also work. And I had a real moment. There's so much about, I know I'm jumping to episode 7, but there's so much about that episode and Misty that I just need to talk about for a minute. So she's pulling a Kathy Bates in misery. Also, her choice when she calls Jessica and then she meets her in the car, the hospital green Fiat, which, amazing. But she's playing the soundtrack to Phantom of the Opera. And we have established that Misty loves show tunes.
Always playing show tunes.
Yes. But Phantom of the Opera, I just thought like, it's a little on the nose that Misty chose like the most ominous Broadway soundtrack.
Or is it just perfection?
Well, she's like, dun, 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 dun. Like, that's what you're playing. Shouldn't you be playing something sort of light and happy so as not to arouse suspicion when Jessica gets into your car? But no, she's like full on playing like the opening of Phantom of the Opera. And then later she's playing Music of the Night. And I was just like, it's amazing. I mean, it could have been worse. She could have been playing Sweeney Todd, but it's just like, what a choice.
Well, and also
choice
that Misty makes so many big choices, and Christina Ricci again is doing such a fantastic job that I think of her as Christina Ricci. I'm not watching the actor at any level. I'm just watching the performance.
Oh yeah.
Because that role is so wild. Yep. And like she has a kidnapping basement. She has a room that is set up.
There's a bed down there. Yeah.
Table and a bed, and she has I'm holding my wrists up to the camera.
She has like 4 sets of handcuffs.
Yeah, but they're long chains. Like they're not just cuffs. Like,
I'm sorry, she has shackles is what shackles. She has. Yes.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for. She's not ad hocking this. She's not ad lib. She's planned to hold someone in this place and prepared everything necessary to do so.
Do we think it's the first time?
There are multiple locks on the outside of the door going down to the basement.
Do you think it's the first time she's held someone down there?
I really don't.
Me too. Yeah, I don't think it could. Like, why do you have that set up, Misty? I mean, maybe it's a sex dungeon. Maybe it's a sex dungeon, but I don't think so.
It's
I think it's for holding people hostage.
Either she bought the house because it has that there, or she creepy. Did it. Those are your two options.
Oh, I think she did it. I do.
I believe so too. But I'm just saying, either way.
Yeah. Because Misty is such an interesting, because teenage Misty is already weird.
Uh-huh.
And out of touch isn't quite right, but she's not. I hate to criticize teenage Misty so much. Like, she's not a normal teenager, and neither was I. I also liked show tunes. I also would have been sitting in my bedroom alone reading on a Friday night. I did not get prank calls from other girls.
Yeah, but that was brutal.
That was brutal. But I was more of a Misty than I was a Jackie. So
that those are our two choices.
Right? Yeah, if that's the spectrum. I was probably closer to like an Aquila or a Van, thank goodness. But anyway, my point being, like, she was odd as a teenager, and she just was sort of like, she's in love with the one coach who survives, and she doesn't even twig that he's gay, which
seems to know nothing about him and never asks him anything about himself. No, she and just I has her idea of who he is to her.
I didn't like think he was hiding it so much. I mean, it's not, you don't look at him and go, that's a gay man. But at the same time, it's like, he is stranded in the woods with all these young women who are, you know, bathing in the lake and stuff, and he's not even paying any attention to it at any point. He really just seems to be like the adult who would be looking after them better if he hadn't lost his leg in the crash.
Yeah, there's a real sense of like, he would be their fearless leader if he could get around. If he could be,
yeah.
And I thought that it was interesting that they made the choice to give him that injury, because the thing that it gives you as the audience is the comfort that he's no threat to them.
Yes, but he didn't seem to be ever anyway. And
absolutely. Yeah. But it absolutely like layers on top of that. Is it?
Yes.
There's not a secret level to this guy where he's going to try to like do things to them or take advantage of this situation.
No.
Like, no, he only wants to help them. He only wants to help them.
Yeah. But he's also the only surviving adult, and he's kind of out of commission. Like, he's limited in what he can do, especially in the beginning, but even later, like, it's not maybe by season four, they will have MacGyvered him some sort of prosthesis.
Right.
But the best they've managed at this point is to MacGyver him some sort of crutches.
Crutches he seems to do okay with.
They're okay, but they're not great. So
sure, but you know,
he's not straying particularly far from the cabin.
Yeah.
He's holding down the fort. He's also, you know, for a good long time, he's healing. That's a massive injury that was not properly taken care of.
It was cauterized with an axe.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
But so Misty, who was the cauterizer, actually, is on the one hand, she's kind of the weird outcast, maybe a little younger than some of the others, probably no younger than Aquila. But she also has some serious first aid and wilderness skills.
Absolutely.
And so she's quite useful. But then there's this weird undercurrent to her that is like, there's just something not right about her. And then it really comes to a head when she finds the black box, the transmitter thing from the plane.
The FDR, yeah.
Flight data recorder, thank you. Mm-hmm. And destroys it because she has just overheard them saying, thank God we have Misty.
She has finally found her element.
We'd be just hooped without her. Like, thank God she's here.
Yeah.
And she makes the decision when she finds the FDR to destroy it, which is like, you couldn't take your props for being good in a crisis.
Nope. I got to stay out here.
Had to prolong the crisis. Mm-hmm. I don't know that she meant to prolong it for 19 months.
No,
she definitely meant to prolong it. And I'm very curious to see if and when we find out, or the other girls find out, that she did that.
My guess is we find out in 2021, she somehow lets that slip. I wonder. They will have found out, because she's still in with them during the events of the opening image in the pilot. And I think that that's the kind of thing that could actually make them turn on her.
Maybe. Because also there is that sort of like, they still don't seem to like her. When she calls, Shauna says, which she doesn't say to any of the others, I told you never to call me.
Yeah.
Like, never.
And not on this number.
No, but whereas the others, it's like, oh, if they're calling, I guess I better go. And she, you know, she contacts Ty.
Yeah.
So to me, I think they might know that. They may have found out, you know, around month 10.
Yeah.
Or because are they going to come across that site at some point?
My guess is she buried it subsequent to.
But we don't see her do it. So who knows? But yeah,
it's interesting the way that she's written, because like you really do see her as just like all this sweet girl who is so desperate for a friend and like human connection, but has no idea how to make that happen. She tries so hard. She is so socially awkward, but it just like, I don't know what the things to say are. Like the way she bops in and out of her workplace in 2021, like, have a good night, ladies. These are things you say to be likable. And the other nurses are like, who the fuck even was that?
But okay, so there's an interesting point, right? So not only is, so she has all these first aid skills and she definitely saves the day in pilot episode 2. I guess like she saves that coach's life.
Yeah.
He would have bled out if she hadn't done what she did. Oh, as absolutely. Horrible and disgusting as it was, he would have died.
It was necessary.
Absolutely. And it was the right decision. And she was the only one who could stomach doing it and saw that it needed to be done. Everyone else was just over there being horrified, which, hey, I might've been too. Like I'm not judging when they pull that plane off his leg and it sort of like stretches and gloops. Like it's
the practical effects of that were amazing. They had his leg, the knee bent down into a hole in the ground. And then,
it was like
all practical effects, like John Carpenter. It was tremendously well executed and shot.
And I may never watch that particular shot again. I've seen it twice now and I never need to see it again.
Yeah.
Ugh. But while everyone else was sort of vomiting and frozen, it was Misty who was like, well, we have to deal with this. And, you know, chopped it off where there was no getting it back and bandaged it and then later cauterized it. And like, she really, you know,
did what needed to be done. Yeah.
He would be dead without her.
And I would say like
some of the rest of them.
The fact that she does maybe, without assigning a pathology to her, the fact that she doesn't feel feelings the way other people feel feelings definitely works in her favor in situations like that, because she doesn't panic. She doesn't, you know, get anxious. She just like sort of, she sees clearly. She doesn't always use the right criteria to make decisions, but she seems to see clearly.
Well, she's able to rise to the occasion, but where I'm going with this is then in present day, she has become a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
So she's still doing this. But there's clearly a part of her that gets off on being in control of the patient.
The power
and when
thing,
we look
for sure.
back, that definitely is visible in the woods. So there's something. And then, you know, she just gets weirder and weirder. Like there's something wrong with Misty, which by the time we get to the kidnapping, I'm like, how far will she go? Is she going to pull a Misery? Is a baseball bat coming out next?
Well, it turns out it's a syringe into a cigarette.
Well, and before that, she was putting fentanyl into chocolates as a threat.
Yeah.
She was putting something into chocolates, whether she was really wasting fentanyl, which I assume is expensive. I don't know, but it sure seemed like it.
Who knows what she was able to palm from the nursing care facility, but
Well, I mean, if it's just a threat, she could have been injecting water into those chocolates to scare Jessica. You know,
you use saline for theater and then you do it for real upstairs.
Exactly. Yeah. If you find you need to, or maybe you get what you want with the threat. And so why would you waste that precious fentanyl that you might need later for murdering? And you know, Jessica's not going to eat those chocolates now if she knows what's in them. Which, also, can I just say, Jessica Roberts, what an amazing pseudonym. What an amazing fake name.
It's a great fake name.
Mm-hmm. Because it sounds real.
And it's so
generic. There are many people named Jessica Roberts. Exactly. It's ungoogleable.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you would never be able to reliably find the right Jessica Roberts.
Yeah. I'm going to, with your indulgence, I'm going to go off of Google ability, and I think we should talk about Adam.
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
So Shauna's boyfriend / stabbed in the chest person.
Rear-ended. First rear-ended him, then he became her boyfriend, then she killed him. Yeah, there was a whole arc there.
Yeah. He had a tough couple of months there.
He really did.
And that was another character where I felt like they towed the line really effectively with the ambiguity. Is he in on something? Mm-hmm. I mean, we still technically maybe don't whole story. No. But I thought it was interesting that Shauna gets onto him, as it were, starts to suspect him, because her daughter is like, yeah, this person doesn't exist. Everyone's on the internet.
Yeah. So who is he really?
Who is he really? What's going on with all of this? And just the domestic subplot of Shauna's life. And like Lunsky said in one of her interviews, where did my notes go? There it is. That she feels like Shauna feels like she needs to be punished for what she did in the woods. And so she's accepted life as like, this is what I deserve.
Right. Given what I did, which is very strongly hinted at. But it was interesting. I saw somebody, I think it was a TV writer on Twitter, but I won't name them in case I'm wrong. Say that they were watching Yellow Jackets and they're like, what is this horrible thing that happened in the woods? I can't figure it out. And I was like, I don't know if you're being facetious or if you're really confused. Like, it is true that, well, it's for anyone who has not seen Yellow Jackets, it's like, so what did happen in the woods? The short answer is cannibalism, maybe. And it's true that we probably, exactly. It's true that we don't actually see it. It looks like
sort of see everything, but
it looks like at best they had to pull an Alive, if you've seen that movie about the team that crashed in, I think it was the Andes,
which was a
real story.
In Argentina in 1972,
And who did eventually have to resort to eating each other, although they didn't kill each other to do it. They just ate the people who were dead.
They successfully died of injuries and cold temperatures because they were at something like 11,000 feet of altitude up in the mountains, and
but the ones
were stuck in the plane.
The ones who survived and just had really nothing to eat had to resort to eating their dead friends.
Yeah.
So it's unclear, but if there was cannibalism, did they have to resort to eating each other because of lack of all other food, or did they start hunting each other because they went full Lord of the Flies? It remains to be seen.
And that's the sort of big question of we have a factual pattern of what we believe happened, but we don't know the motivation as of yet or who was involved in what aspects of what behavior exactly, except for Misty, as we talked about before.
Yes. But what we see in that opening sequence is indicative. Like, they certainly want us to think that that's what happened, that they started hunting and eating each other.
Yes.
But also the pit with the sticks that she falls into, my wilderness skills are not up to snuff, but I do believe that that's a bear trap.
I tend to refer to that as a tiger trap. Just that's my personal experience of
but
a
there
pit
are
with
no
sticks.
There are no tigers.
No, I know there's no tigers. No, I'm aware of that.
In this area, that would be used for bears, probably. Because a wolf might be able to jump over it. But a bear wouldn't.
Perhaps a moose or something, anything huge.
A moose is a fun fact about moose. They are extremely tall.
Yeah.
So a moose, like, way taller than you. If you've never seen a moose in person, listeners, they are like huge. Like, they're not quite as tall as a house, but
they're elephantine.
Maybe like a small bungalow. Like, they are extremely tall. Like
10 foot at the shoulder.
The first time I saw one, I was shocked at how tall it was. Yeah. And where I'm going with that is a moose is tall enough that it would see that that was a hole from far enough away to walk around it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, that's
it's not dumb enough to fall in.
Okay.
It's not dumb at all, actually. A moose is not dumb. Fair. Bullwinkle notwithstanding. And they are tall enough that I think that they would be able to see that from far enough away to avoid it. Whereas a bear... Yeah. When it's walking around
lower
on all fours,
ground.
Would kind of be right up on it. And oops, not that bears are stupid either. They're very smart. But I think it's more likely that a bear that was just kind of like galumphing along might accidentally fall in there. So I don't think they can jump the way that, say, a wolf could. A wolf might be able to jump over something like that. But I don't, if it saw it coming.
Yeah.
Also, hunting wolves seems like a bad idea because they are pack animals. Like, you're never going to get just one. So if you find one on its own and you kill it, its friends are coming for you. I wouldn't advise it.
That's so funny.
Yeah. But anyway, so we see her fall into that trap, and then later we see her sort of strung up like an animal would be if you had to bleed it out after hunting it.
Yeah.
And then we see them cooking and eating, but we do not. And I'm glad we don't see the bit in between, because that I would be done with the show.
don't want to see that. Yep, I'm comfortable.
Nope, I don't even like the implication.
Yeah,
but I do. And at the first, so I've watched the show 170% times. I've seen it. I saw it all hilarious. The way through, and then I've made it back through season episode 7 at this point. I have three more to go before I'm done watching for a second time. But on my first watch, I was very afraid of what I might see.
Yeah. Yeah.
As we went forward, and I was ready to have to turn it off at any moment if it got too gory, because everything we see in that first sequence is suggested and in the background are blurry enough.
Yeah.
That it could, like, if it were shot differently, I would not have made it through the opening sequence. But the way it's shot is like, is that what's happening? It sure looks like that's what's happening. And but so I spent the whole time in fear of what I would have to look at. And then going back through the second time, I feel like I know what I have to look at. And there are times when it's at my threshold for I can't watch this, but it hasn't crossed it yet.
I think there are that it's shot and edited in such a way that they have deniability. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to go back on, well, they didn't actually, they hunted and killed each other, but then they didn't actually resort to cannibalism.
Also, like,
I think you could walk around some of those bits.
Do we know that that's true? Do we know that's not Misty's fantasy? Not really.
It could be a dream sequence. It could be.
Yeah, we have no idea. Because we've seen some weird dream sequences. Like Shauna apparently giving birth to a fried chicken. Like.
That was, pregnancy dreams, I'm told, are a very real, very strange thing, so.
I wouldn't know. But yeah, I think there will come a time when the timeline becomes clearer, because I think when they get to Doom Coming, she is maybe just starting to show.
Uh-huh, because she needs help zipping up her dress.
Yeah, so what I know about teenage pregnancy, not having had one, but having gone to school with girls who did.
Oh boy.
Is that at that age and being in good shape, you start to show month 4 or 5.
Sort of my instinct as well.
Often a little bit later than a woman who's a little older or who has already had a pregnancy would. Mm-hmm. So I think we can get away with it till she's about 5 months along, and then it's going to be undeniable. Although here's a question on the topic of pregnancy.
Oh.
Misty, adult Misty. Mm-hmm. Are we supposed to just be ignoring the fact that Christina Ricci is very clearly pregnant?
I believe that they are trying to dress her around it.
Okay. Because it's pretty obvious a couple of times.
There's a couple of times where it's just like,
Well, and it's just, to me anyway, and I didn't know until doing the research that the actress is indeed pregnant and was 7 months pregnant when they finished filming.
I didn't.
But there were a couple of times where I was like, that really looks like that's a pregnancy belly. That's.
I didn't want to assume, but I'm glad that you are the one to say it out loud.
I was pretty sure. I mean, people have all different body types, but also having seen Christina Ricci on screen since she was a child.
Literally a Wednesday Addams.
Literally. Yeah. Even before like Mermaids times. I really was like, Christina Ricci's pregnant. Or Miss, like, that is what she would look. Is Misty pregnant? Am I supposed to, are they hinting that Misty is pregnant, or are they?
I don't think so.
Because she sure looks it. Like, it doesn't, it does not read as Misty has a belly for any reason other than that she's pregnant.
I think they were trying to dress around it and just didn't quite get there in every single shot.
Yeah, there's one shot in particular where she's sitting in a chair, and I thought, like, oh, if you don't, that should be.
I noticed it in, you should have, like,
should have framed her.
A walking shot where she was coming towards the camera, and there was just something about the way her scrubs were.
Yeah. And scrubs can sort of tent, like, you can get away with it for a while. And because they filmed this over time, there are times when it's not apparent, and then there are times where it's very apparent. Like, the longer you go in the season, the more apparent it becomes, and they just don't address it. And it was like, I don't see when Misty would have gotten pregnant based on what we've seen.
Yeah.
There were those couple of bad dates, but nobody, like, even the guy who came home as soon as they walked in and Natalie was there with a rifle, he was like, well, I'm leaving.
So. I need to jump off for a quick second. So I'm going to have to get to this in editing, but I will be right back. Okay, so this is the giantest episode, and we should probably start to think about wrapping two extra things I really wanted to get to.
Let's do it.
We started to talk about it when you were saying that Van was describing the plot of a movie.
Oh, yes.
In episode 7, when they had their exploration mission. I don't know mm-hmm. what to call it, their doomed expedition.
Yes.
And I thought that they did a really interesting thing with Van, which is that they brought in what I would call three survival tropes or anti-survival tropes in a, you know, sort of horror scenario, mm-hmm. which is there's three kinds of people who get killed off based on who they are and what their conduct is in scenarios mm-hmm. like this, when you're expecting a cast to be whittled down. Yep. One is what I'm going to call the life of the party trope, which is what we talked about. If she's like entertaining everybody, she's talking about the movie, she's clearly very vital to the like success of the, you know, emotional health.
Yes, she's good for morale.
She's good for morale. That's exactly what I was thinking. The second trope is the when we get home character.
Oh, yes.
We're going to go to New York. I'm going to buy you a soft pretzel. We're going to ride a carriage ride in New York City. Like, they just hit both of those so hard. And the third one is, and I'm sorry, this is the name of the trope, but it's the kill your gaze trope.
It's actually called bury your gaze, but yes.
My mistake. I wrote it down wrong. But the bury your gaze trope, it's kind of like, you know, horror movies in the late 20th century, especially in the 90s, I think, you know, the black character often gets it first, which they name-check
that trope was also in discussed. The episode
itself.
Yep.
And so like they've got all of these meta signals that Van is not long for this world.
Yeah.
And at the end of the episode. Oh no, go ahead.
I'm so sorry, but just because you said it, they do name check that trope. And I love the moment of just when she says to Ty, why does the black character always die first? And then there's just kind of silence in which you know that what's in Ty's brain is the obvious answer, racism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They almost look down the barrel of the camera.
They do. And they don't say it, but you can also see that Van realize it and it's not said, but you kind of see them both think Ty first as if like this is dead obvious because it is, especially to her. But then her white girlfriend, Van, takes a minute and then you see her think it without like, right. Yeah. Because the world is horribly racist. Right.
Yeah. Because this is where and when we are. But clearly the show is that we know the tropes. And so they are giving us everything we think we need to understand this character. Okay, we're prepping ourselves to say goodbye.
Yes. And we know we have not seen her as an adult yet. So there's every possibility that Van doesn't make it.
And there still may be, but as for her getting attacked by wolves, she survives that. And like, seems mostly fine after her wounds heal, which is amazing.
But they did it so well because we do truly think she's dead when it happens. Because
at the end of the episode, she's gone. Yeah.
It happens at the end of episode 7. They have, I think it is the Wilhelm scream, although I can't prove it.
Oh, I don't remember hearing it, but I'd have to go back and pay attention.
Thaisa does that like rock back on your knees, scream at the sky thing. And I think they put in the Wilhelm scream for it.
Oh, interesting.
If they didn't, the actress is doing a fantastic job of it. she's doing it.
My guess is it's really her because the Wilhelm is so distinctive. I'll put a link to it so y'all listeners can listen to it.
It was substituted in for my scream in my episode of Supernatural.
Oh my gosh, so, that's so funny.
Yeah. So it gets used for all genders. And of course, now we have equipment that can change the pitch and change the length and change the, anyway.
Yeah.
But yes, maybe it's her because she screams the way that you expect a character to scream in that instant when the person they love has just died in front of them and they were unable to save them. And that's where the episode ends.
Yeah.
And it's
hard
not
cut
until
to black.
The next episode, which if you were watching in real time on Showtime, I believe it dropped week to week. They had to wait a week for that.
Yep, that was me. I watched it in real time after midnight because it drops, you know, 12:01. Okay. So I was watching it first thing each day.
Wow. By the time it came to Crave and I watched it, the whole first season was there.
Yeah.
So I did not have to wait any longer than I felt like waiting. And I do believe I watched that immediately because that was a real cliffhanger. Like I had to.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. That's one where you keep going. but we really think she's dead for a little while into that episode too.
Yeah.
And then basically it's when they're trying to dispose of her body.
They are like, they built her a funeral pyre and she's like, fuck, are you serious?
And she wakes up and it's like, oh no.
Yeah.
Put this fire out, get her off there. Like, we didn't think you were still alive.
I was, that was one of my favorite moments watching the show live. First of all, I was so glad to not have that spoiled, but also just like, that is one of the moments that made me really fall in love with the show, because having watched episode 7 and have them deploy all of these tropes of get ready to say goodbye to this character.
Yeah.
It's like, all right, fine show. I guess we're doing this. And then they're like, oh, you saw me coming. Episode 8, you are my heart. You saw me coming. You knew what I was going to think. And you just let me bite down hard on that.
I also really love that character and I really enjoy that actress. So I was happy to have Van Rules and Liv Hewson Rules. And I was glad that they were both continuing.
She has a really interesting anecdote in one of the, I think, interview pieces that I read, I think is probably Vulture, where she talked about how they did the stitching up scene.
Oh, I have to stop for 1 second and remind us both that Liv Hewson uses they, them pronouns. Oh,
you're right. I'm so, sorry about that.
The character of Van, apparently uses she, her. She's always referred to as she. So the character identifies as a woman or a girl, I suppose. She's a teenager. I hate the word female. It makes it so...
It's
just sound like cows or something.
Anthropological in an unapproachable way.
So Van identifies as a woman or a girl and uses she, her pronouns. Liv Hewson identifies as non-binary and uses they, them pronouns. So when we talk about Liv, we will use they, them. And when we talk about Van, we will use she, her.
Okay.
Please continue.
Absolutely. Thank you for reminding me to be careful of that, or be mindful, I should say. So Liv Hewson, oh my gosh, I just did it again.
That's why I reminded you again.
Yep.
They.
Okay, deep breath. Liv Hewson, they are not actually injured. They just have a prosthetic over the side of their face and like some green screen paint is the way they described it.
You don't injure the actor.
No, obviously. I'm describing.
Sorry.
I know that people don't think they actually had their face ripped open.
God, I hope not.
But I thought
people do think that, they need to learn about prosthetic makeup.
I thought the description of it was really fascinating, the actual prosthesis, because the show went through. Basically what happens is that there was like a plastic plate against the side of their face and then the prosthesis over that. And so Kia King, who's playing Akila, is actually stitching into, you know, a piece of prosthetic makeup. But Liv Hewson, she was saying she can't feel that. And so what was happening is Jasmine Savoy Brown, who plays Thaisa, is holding Liv's head in her lap. And so Jasmine was like applying pressure to the back of Liv's neck.
She would have been tapping her or something. So exactly. She knew when to react. Yeah.
Yeah. So Liv knows how hard and like what the reaction is supposed to be based on this feedback from her co-star. I just thought that was such an interesting
it's a wonderful example anecdote of the ways that actors work together and support each other in a scene that the public who are not actors don't know. That yes, often you are relying on a co-star for something like that, to get the timing of something, to know, because if you can't see it from your position, which obviously they could not, Liv could not from their position because it's on their face. And there's no good way to rig up any kind of a mirror that wouldn't be in the shot so they could watch.
Yeah, that would be awkward.
Yeah, but they do have other actors around them. And so that's the kind of thing that is often happening, you know, because so many injury scenes and such happen, and of course they're not real, so you're not feeling it. So if you can't see it, there has to be some indicator off screen, whether it's someone acting with you or someone on the set off camera letting you know. But yes, that's one of the ways, and it's super simple and brilliant, and it's probably the best way to do it, is to have the other actor who's holding your head give you some sort of indication of how you should be reacting. So I think that's amazing.
And the like clenched tooth scream of agony through that. I just, that was, it was it surprised me with how like compelling it was. Like it was hard to watch.
Yeah.
From Liv's performance.
Which it should be.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
If they weren't selling it, we wouldn't believe it. So
yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like they found in this case the plural they, that those actors, the three of them really found the way, the best way to communicate that, because all three of them had to be in sync. You've got one person doing the sewing, and you've got another person watching that and indicating to the third person who's being sewn in quotes.
Exactly.
when to give a reaction. So that's I love that teamwork, and I love
it was such a great story.
I love that they talked about that.
It occurs to me also that the prosthetic, if you're actually puncturing it with the sewing needle, then you have a limited number of those that you don't want to use up. So like everybody really has to be in sync, you know, to make good use of your prop. And
although it depends on what it's made of and how sort of permanent and visible the needle holes are.
The camera got pretty up close and personal.
But also if you've got like fake blood around and stuff, that can really disguise. You think about any medical show with surgery scenes, that's all happening too.
Yeah.
And so clearly props people have figured out how to do this and how, I mean, either, yes, they may very well be making multiples probably because even if you drop it, you might, you know, this might now become unusable.
Yeah.
There should always be a backup for everything, basically.
Of course.
Only on a low budget film do you only have one, and do you only get one try. The other exception to that, of course, is explosions.
Yeah.
Generally, for an explosion, a big one, you only get one shot because you're blowing up something.
A lot of big actions stunts have that.
Yeah. Because often you're actually blowing up, say, a scale model. But also, how many of those do you have? Those are expensive too. So for some stuff, and especially if there's any practical kind of thing, and you've got actors in the shot, and like you're probably only getting one shot at that. But for something like this, you probably have a few of them that you can use in case you know, because stuff happens too. You can have three actors acting their asses off, and a hair gets in the lens.
Yep.
Or in the gate, rather, and now come on, right?
Yep.
I guess we don't have gates anymore, so we don't use film cameras. But you know, a plane can go by that shouldn't be going. Like, you can't have a plane go by in that scene would immediately drop everything and wave at it. Like,
exactly.
Yeah. So all kinds of things can happen that you have to account for.
Yeah. Well, I will say, I hope both for the sake of Liv Hewson and my enjoyment of the show that Van isn't going anywhere anytime soon.
Me too.
I'm curious who they might cast to play the older version of her if she does indeed survive and is a part of the story in 2021.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would like to know, will we meet adult Van, and how did her life go? Where is she? What's she doing?
Yeah.
Because clearly she and Ty aren't together.
But that's not necessarily indicative of whether or not she survived, because how many high school relationships
really
survive until, well.
Exactly. So it's, on the one hand, we know that Ty married someone else, made a family with someone else. But because they were high school sweethearts, that we don't know. Maybe. Yeah. Also, I get the sense that Ty is definitely not out. And whether Van is a question.
Yeah, it seems to be a bit of a gray area.
I think it's pretty obvious in Van's case.
I think so, retrospective from a modern lens. Mm-hmm. But I will say that, like, sort of putting my 90s brain into that show, if I'd been, you know, Travis or Javi amongst that group, I probably would not have a good sense of who was what.
It's also the time of grunge, so there's just a lot of flannel around.
That's the other thing, is like they're all wearing
that is one of our tells. It's one of our main tells. But like Shauna's walking around in flannel, so you can't really tell from that.
Yeah,
so who knows, like we were all wearing flannel at that point. Like, sexual orientation be damned, it was grunge, which I know you have one other point you want to talk about.
Does it
by any chance have anything to do with 90s music?
No, I think this is a good time for a segue for that.
Oh, okay. Because I'd like to a little bit cover 90s music just for a second.
Go for it. I thought so much of the music was perfect, but I don't recognize a lot of it in terms of like, I don't know the names of the people. I just know I've heard this song a million times on the radio and in other media. Yeah.
Some of them immediately jumped out at me and some I had to look up. But like Kiss from a Rose.
Oh my God. Absolutely. Seal. Perfect. Yeah.
There's also In Shauna's Bedroom in 1996 at home before this all happens, or in the flashbacks anyway. There's a Kurt Cobain poster. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was so perfect because it's 96. Absolutely. So he would have died about 2 years before.
Yeah.
He died in 94. And yeah. So he was very, very much in the consciousness during grunge times. But yeah, I think their musical choices are so on point. They're so 90s. Mm-hmm. So is the clothing and the hair. And like, they just, it looks like my adolescence.
Yeah.
It's done so beautifully. But the thing I really want to talk about 90s music wise is the show theme song.
Oh, okay.
Because I was sure that it was pulled from the 90s. I was sure that this was some kind of the credit, the song over the credits. I was sure this was some deep cut 90s grunge indie thing. And I was like, what is that? Because that, like, it's obviously called No Return because it's said a million times. But like, was that whole? Was that? Yeah. You know, who was that?
That would be my assumption if I had thought about it at all. Yeah.
Yeah. I looked it up. It was written for the show.
Wow.
It is an original. And in fact, you can buy it on, you know, iTunes or whatever as a single.
Of course.
Yeah. But it's specifically written for that credit sequence, but it's written by two people who are veterans of the 90s indie alternative scene. And that's why it's so perfect is they were doing that music then and they pulled out their songwriting skills to do that music now. But I just, it's so perfect. The whole, honestly, the whole theme sequence or the whole credit sequence on at the top of the show is so perfect with the, like, is clearly like an old VCR VHS, tape.
Yeah.
It's so amazing. Uh-huh. I love it so much. I was hoping that this right here would tell me who wrote it, who wrote the song.
But yeah, I like the sort of barrage of imagery in that opening title. And it doesn't kick in until episode 3, but it gives you a really good sense of what the show is and the sort of like expect the unexpected undercurrent of it.
Yeah, I guess my assumption is they didn't have it for the pilot and that for episode 2 it was probably cut for time.
Could have been. They just wanted to jump right in.
Yeah, because I would have expected them to have it by then. But sometimes, and you'll see this even with like established shows, there are times when the credit sequence off the top is just cut.
Yeah.
Because they wanted that extra 45 seconds or whatever for content in the show. So they just put the actors' names up over the action instead of.
And I feel like that happens a lot more in commercial TV than something like Showtime HBO.
But it's a network thing. Yeah.
There's still time, is still time. You have to make use of your airwaves.
Yeah. And if this were a Netflix show or something, I don't think they would have done it. We would have gotten the credit sequence, but because it aired on Showtime, they are bound by their time rules.
Yeah.
Although their time is longer, these shows are almost a full hour. They're like 57 minutes long.
Yeah.
They still do have rules about
still got promos to put up.
It can be exactly. And so I assume it was cut for time, but it's just, I love the moment when it flickers from teenage Shauna to adult Shauna, for instance, like
that is so like that. Great. Yeah, I want that.
And it's so
gift.
Brilliant to like, because that casting in particular is very good. Sophie Nelisse and Melanie Linsky.
Yeah.
Sophie is Canadian. She was born, I looked it up, she was born in Windsor. I knew I recognized her and I realized it's because she was in a Canadian film called Wait Till Helen Comes.
Okay.
I watched part of because it's based on a book I read as a child and I couldn't believe they made a movie about it in like 2016.
Yeah,
they made a movie of this novel I read in 1987. What? They did.
Well, and we mentioned it off the air, but just to say real quick, Sophie Nelisse is blonde haired and blue eyed, and they gave her contacts to match Melanie Linsky, which I think is great.
Yes.
And you and I were saying, again, I think before we started recording, that's a thing that often gets neglected when you're matching actors to play older, younger versions of each other is eye color.
Eye color is so important. There's one example of it that has bothered me for I guess 25 years or something, 20 years because there's an episode, maybe even I think it's a two-parter, in sort of in the middle of the X-Files run. I want to say it's their Christmas episodes in season 5. They did a two-parter.
Okay.
And Scully, played by Gillian Anderson, in case anyone's been living under a rock, she is dreaming about herself as a child.
Okay.
As like a four-year-old, probably four or five, really little, really little. And they had previously, the episode, yeah, it is. It's the episode called Christmas Carol. And so there are all these flashbacks. So they actually have a couple of versions of her younger self.
Okay.
One of whom, the teenage version, is very smartly, they just cast her younger sister because
oh, nice.
She happens to have a sister who's something like 14 years younger than she is.
That's convenient.
And who looks, or looked, I don't know what she looks like now, but at the time, remarkably like her.
Yeah.
Like, it was insane. And also, you know, they just, because their sister's same eye color, same hair texture, same, you know, so yeah. they just used
her. That's a gimme.
Her otherwise not an actor, you know, like 15-year-old sister came in and played this role. But for the little version, they used a little girl whose name I do not know and do not care to spend the time looking up right now. But what bothered me about it is Jillian's eyes are blue. Mm-hmm. And this little girl had brown eyes. And there was so much focus on her face, like close up, right? Not extreme close up where you don't see her whole face, but you see her whole face filling the frame. And the whole time I was like, I understand you can't give context to a four-year-old, but I also know that even in the late 90s, you could change a lot in post. In those same,
do some color correction.
They could have done it because in those same episodes, they, and this will be the end of my X-Files digression, but I knew they could have done it, and it bothered me that they didn't, because in that same pair of episodes, it's a two-parter, and they had filmed the whole first episode with one child mm-hmm. playing a different role as a child.
Oh, interesting.
I'm not trying, you know, I don't want to have to explain the entire plot of the X-Files. There's a little girl called Emily in these episodes, and Emily was played by one child whose name I will never know, because in episode two of that two-parter, whatever was going on, there were a bunch of scenes in a hospital and she got scared and couldn't do the scenes because she was like four and there were machines around and she just got freaked out. She's four. And so they ended up finding another little girl who was about seven, but really small for her age. And so was just old enough that she wouldn't be freaked out and she had more experience. So they ended up filming that whole second episode with her. And then they had to go back and film the first episode with her. And they didn't have Jillian by that point. She was two episodes ahead. So they used her stunt double, and then they had to cut it all together in editing. And in doing this, they realized that there was a whole scene where they had put this little girl in the wrong outfit.
Oh my God.
And they had to digitally change her outfit in post. And they also, the first little girl, because any scenes from the back where it was, if she was facing Jillian, all of her scenes are with Jillian Anderson.
Coverage, yeah.
Yeah. So where you had Jillian, the first little girl's hair was really, really light, like white blonde. And the second little girl's hair was a much darker blonde. And so they had to change her hair color in all those shots from the back. And then, there's a whole scene where they had to digitally change because they'd put little girl number two in the wrong clothes and they had to change it. And so knowing all of, and this was like, I don't know, 1998, 99, 97, somewhere in there.
I bet that this episode doesn't look great if you go back now. The effects maybe don't hold up.
I've seen it many times and no, it's pretty seamless. Like you don't
really,
you can't tell. I would have told you that girl number two played the role the whole time. I had no idea.
Cool.
Shout out to the editors and the color people and everybody who did that. It's amazing. It's Christmas Carol and the episode that comes after it. But so knowing that they had done all that, even back then, I was like, why didn't you change the little girl's eye color?
Yep.
Eyes sometimes go from blue to brown, from usually in babies. They never go from brown to blue.
Yeah, that's just correct.
Yeah. So anyway, long digression, but they could have color corrected and they didn't. So I appreciate that in Yellow Jackets, they have fixed that.
Well, and the thing that I like about it especially is that it gives Sophie's performance a little bit more intensity because her eyes are just a little bit darker than a normal brown-eyed person's eyes are.
Oh, interesting. I would think they'd be slightly lighter. That's fascinating.
Well, because you're layering, right, the brown color contacts on top of her regular eyes. And so it just, they seem darker to me.
I also don't know how light blue her eyes are.
like, sort of medium blue.
There are different shades of blue.
But additional Sophie Nellie's fun fact, she's left-handed. And so she had to talk to Melanie Lynskey about the journal writing scenes.
Oh, because Melanie's right-handed, is she?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, I mean, I don't know. I'm just,
And so like that was just, she was talking on one of the interviews about her process and, you know, matching a performance to another actor.
Right. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, one of you has to switch.
One of you's got to switch.
It's probably not going to be Melanie.
let's just say.
But she seems very sweet. Who knows? If she were ambidextrous, maybe she'd agree to switch. I don't know.
I think if she were asked to, she probably would, because that is my sense of her as a person and as a professional performer as well. It's just like, you know what, whatever is needed for me to do, that's not a
Melanie Lynskey really is work juice adjacent, which automatically means she's good people.
Absolutely. But the other,
there are no
the
bad
other,
people adjacent to them.
Absolutely. The other matching thing that just popped into my head that I absolutely loved was the scene we touched on it briefly when Shauna stabs Adam. I will say they visually regress the character by putting Sophie Nellie in her Yellow Jackets wardrobe from 96 in the scene.
Yeah.
Doing Amazing. The stabbing. And so they sort of hot swap the actresses midstream. And so you are seeing like what this means to Shauna is like, this is, I'm reacting with this, you know, the core of my being from when I was a kid. She is so still stuck in this trauma response all these years later that
the
in
part
a
of
way,
me that came out in the woods is coming out again.
Exactly. In a way, I'm still a teenager in the forest. And that's the part of me that's killing you right now. And I just, it really, it just was such an overwhelming moment the first time. The second time through is still just, this is so, it just was so well executed because they're doing coverage where you're sort of over the shoulder with both parties. So both characters, Shauna, Adam. But then as they're switching Adam to Shauna, one of the times it's young Shauna and then Adam, old Shauna, Adam, young Shauna, Adam, old Shauna, not old, but older.
Yeah, adult Shauna.
Adults,
Melanie Lynskey's only 44. I would assume adult Shauna is about
no,
the
that
same
doesn't
age.
Count as old. I just was young and old. I was simplifying in my head, and that was not the right thing to do.
Teen Shauna, adult Shauna. You had another point that you wanted to really get to, so let's do that, because this is the mother of all episodes.
My actual last point in the mother of all episodes. So we talked about tropes with Van. The other really tropey subplot throughout this was Jeff's infidelity.
Oh, yes.
And I really loved what Warren Cole did in this role. And we don't need to dive too deep into this because, again, we're running very long. But I've seen him in stuff over the years and just is an actor I really appreciate. And so they hit all those boxes of like mysterious phone calls and text messages at work late at night at a hospital. Again, this show sees us coming. It knows what we're going to think. Turns out, nope, there really is a problem with the inventory database.
Yep.
And there's, I think it's right after Where You Are season in
well, I've seen the whole thing. So.
Yeah. But I mean, where you've just come back to, but in episodes 8 and 9, they have a couple of really great scenes where she is telling him everything that she's been up to. And when I was going to book club, that's where I was going. I was going to see this guy. And Warren Cole says, there's no book club.
I couldn't believe he believed in book club. That was a hilarious moment. It's like, you thought book club was real?
It turned out he was just incredibly sincere, hardworking guy who really was just sort of stuck in his own world with the store.
He was also the blackmailer.
I agree, but he was... I'm not saying he was a morally righteous person, but I'm just saying he believed what he believed. He was there was no subterfuge on Jeff's part. He was just trying to run his store and, like, you know, perform parental and husband like masculinity for his family. But the Dateline scene that comes right after that when he says, you know what, we've watched Dateline, we know how this works, we know we're not going to get away from this. Away with this, I'm gonna take the fall. And she's just like, honey, no.
Yeah, no.
But I just, the fact that he was so just like, he's so devoted to his wife and his marriage, even though he doesn't do everything super well, his unshakability really moved me.
I have a question for you.
Yes, please.
It's to do with Jeff. At what point did you start to think Jeff was the blackmailer?
I never thought it was. I thought it was Adam. until she, like, you know, confronts him. That's what I was looking for. Until she's in the closet and looking at her safe and asking him about it. And he spills immediately, by the way, like no poker face on Jeff. It did not occur to me. I was not in front of that at all.
Okay. Cause I thought, when she found the glitter in the closet.
Yep.
I immediately knew it could have been there before.
Uh-huh.
Because Adam is not in the closet until after they have slept together.
Yep.
So why would there not be glitter in the bed? Why would there not be
anywhere?
How would
else
there be glitter
house?
On him at that point?
Yeah.
And how would she not have seen it before?
Yeah.
In that whole time. So that definitely there. But I actually think on my rewatch, I realized they telegraphed it so much earlier, and I can't believe I didn't catch it.
Oh, what did you see?
Shauna doesn't get a postcard.
Oh yeah, no, I noticed that too, but that didn't.
But that right there should mm-hmm. have told me.
And that someone who knows her was involved.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Because,
and also that he's not a very good blackmailer.
No, he sucks at it.
Because
he's bad at crime.
If he were any good, he would have sent her a postcard, leaving her out because he didn't.
It draws focus.
Yeah, well, and he didn't want her to know what he was up to.
Mm-hmm.
But did he really think that she wouldn't find out from the other Yellow Jackets that something was up?
Well, let me answer that. Yes, he really thought she wouldn't find out from the other Yellow Jackets that something was up.
That's why he's
bad at
kind
crime.
Of a dum-dum. Uh-huh. Because what he should have done was send, it would have thrown her off the trail if he had sent her a postcard.
I absolutely agree with that.
Yeah, he should have. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just like, I remember watching that and thinking, he's a real dumb blackmailer. He's real bad at this because mm-hmm. by leaving his wife out, like I should have known right then.
Yeah.
Not even just when she doesn't get one in the beginning when we see that the others have them.
Yeah.
But when she's in the motel room mm-hmm. with Natalie and Ty and they're like, well, we both got one of these and so did Misty. You didn't get one. She's like, no. And what, blackmail? And in that moment, I thought,
mm-hmm.
we all should have known right then for sure that it was Jeff, because there's no other explanation for her not getting one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just, he's a simple man.
Yeah. But on my first watch, it was the glitter in the closet. And also I remember watching, like, he was the guy running away with the bag. Uh-huh. Looked a little like him to me.
It probably really was.
It probably really is that
Warren
actor.
Cole,
and I remember
yeah.
thinking that could easily be Jeff. And then there was the glitter in the closet. And I was like,
yeah.
I think it's Jeff.
But Peter is playing Adam. He's the same physical type. So like I could kind of see it both
similar
ways.
Similar enough. Yeah.
Yeah.
But then how could he have gotten back to her house the same night without a trace of glitter on him? Have you ever dealt with glitter?
Yes.
It's everywhere days later.
Well, let me tell you a very, very fast glitter story. My freshman year of college, they put little stars on our mm-hmm. doors with our names on them in the dorms, and they had glitter on them. Mm-hmm. And I found that gold glitter after multiple moves, multiple mm-hmm. locations. It's still stuck to my stuff 20 years later.
Yeah.
It's a
it gets
nightmare.
Everywhere.
I hate glitter. But yeah, just to finish up on Shauna and Jeff real fast, mm-hmm. that sequence that they have that's, you know, intercut with other scenes, but when he ultimately reveals, or when she finds out, maybe is a better way to phrase it, that he has known, like it's first of all, anyone listening, don't read anyone's journals. Not acceptable.
No,
but,
don't do that.
But in this case, he has known everything about her, their whole marriage,
mm-hmm.
and has never wavered.
Yeah.
Like that kind of blew me away. Just mm-hmm. you know, this show it shows you like simple things that turn out to be complex and complex things that turn out to be simple, and just the way that it's written, it's so fucking good.
I mean, I think he already knew that she was not a saint, and she knew the same about him because they were messing around when he was Jackie's boyfriend.
Yeah, and he stands up for her at tragedy brunch, which I thought was great as well.
Yes, yeah. So, but clearly, like they both knew that. You know, they had done some questionable things.
They knew who,
like,
they are.
Jackie is her best friend and his girlfriend, and yet the two of them are mm-hmm. like having sex behind Jackie's back. Mm-hmm. So already questionable behavior, but whatever went on in the woods, yeah, he knows about it. I also thought on the rewatch, I saw, we actually do see the code that she puts into the safe. And I thought, oh yeah, I bet that's the flight number, which it is.
Oh, you were in front of that too.
Yeah, I thought, why would you make the code to the safe the flight number of the famous flight that you were on and think no one would guess it? That's wild.
Easy to remember. And again, maybe it goes to the trauma response. And like Melanie was saying, that maybe Shauna kind of feels like she deserves for something bad to happen. So if I make the code obvious, you know, subconsciously
maybe, yeah.
If the code is obvious, someone's likely to guess it, and then all my secrets will be revealed, which is what I deserve.
Like, this is my Yellow Jackets box, so I will lock it with a famous number tied to the Yellow Jackets that anybody who's ever watched the news could guess. Yeah. Because you know, when a flight goes down, we talk about the flight number.
Yep.
There's no way.
And sometimes they retire numbers because flight numbers are reused.
Unique. All the time. Yeah. I am often on the same flight to places when I take flights because that flight at that time on that day is the same number every time.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that we're going to have to wrap up because we could talk about this for
insanely long. It might be two episodes.
You know what? That's not the worst idea. We'll see how the actual shakes out.
Yeah, if there's a reasonable place to split it, we might have to split it. So listeners, maybe this is two episodes. Maybe it's a super long episode. If you're still listening to this and following it, thank you.
Yeah.
Because I know we jumped all over the place on Yellow Jackets. I mean, I think
it's hard not.
The bottom line is, there's so much going on. It's such a compelling show. I personally do not find it to be very bingeable because the episodes are on the long side, and also the subject matter. I mean, it has some very funny moments. It also has some very
dark
moments.
Oh yeah.
It's definitely a drama, but it has a couple of laugh out loud moments. It's really, it's brilliantly done, but it's also a lot. So now Chris is able to binge it. I'm not, we're just different people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to pick three of my prediction questions for us to talk about real, real fast. Lightning round.
Okay, speed round. Lightning round.
So the Antler Queen, obviously it is Lottie at the beginning. Is it always Lottie? Do we think she's always in charge? Because I have a theory based on, this is my one sort of performance feedback, is that it seems to me that Melanie Lynskey, when she's with the other jackets, is performing a sort of I am a person who used to have some measure of power and authority, and I no longer do. Like, my life is less than it was before. So it would not surprise me if Shauna had been the Antler Queen at some point.
I think that crown might get passed around.
I think that's possible. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is a very long conversation, but we're going to do it as a yes or no because we're in the lightning round. Lottie have magical or psychic powers?
No.
No. My feeling is no as well. The medication that she takes is called Loxapine, which is a fictional medication. I Googled this a little bit. The theory is that it's a stand-in for Loxapine, different spelling, which is an antipsychotic drug for schizophrenia.
Yeah.
And so I think that she just has some stuff going on.
Yeah, Lottie is not magical. Lottie is off her meds.
Yes. And
I think that's really easily telegraphed early on when we see her find her pills and count them, and she's got like 9-4
or something. Yeah. It's
like
not enough.
She's got like a handful. Like, she maybe has a week's worth, which is they were supposed to be gone a week. So I assume, I didn't actually count them, but I would just kind of my visual memory says there's like 8 or 9 there. It's probably 7 or 8, right? Yeah. It's enough for a week. And so of course she runs out of them really quickly. We see her take the last one and then she starts. So I think my explanation for that, she's off her meds. That's
and her so-called dreams and predictions are confirmation bias and coincidence. That's what I'm comfortable with.
I mean, I think she's absolutely having those dreams.
But the idea that they're connected to real things like the river of blood or whatever. It's like, this is the thing that happened. And we're not remembering all the things that she said that didn't have a follow on because confirmation bias. Yeah.
I mean, unless they decide to go full Lost with this and make it supernatural.
Right.
But at this point, I don't think she's supernatural.
Okay. And then let's see, we kind of talked about who else might have survived. The cults or whatever that kidnapped Natalie at the end in 2021, that's obviously going to be, I think, a really big storyline. But I'm going to go with our last question here is, what happened to poor little Javi? We see him at Doom coming, and then a full day and night go by and we don't see him again. That's the night that Jackie freezes to death.
Yeah.
Is Javi gone as well? What do we think?
Likely.
It seems likely to me because you, if you're outside, you die when the temperature gets too low. There's just nothing else for it.
Yes. And because Jackie dies the same night outside, mm-hmm. even though she's sitting in front of a fire she's made.
Yeah.
And then there's the fact that when they go looking for Travis in the present and find him and he's dead,
yeah,
there is no mention of finding Javi.
That's the other thing that I really didn't think about a lot, but it's the fact that it didn't come up.
Yeah. At no point were they like, we need to talk to Javi.
Yeah.
We should, like, does he know? Should we tell him? Mm-hmm. Should we, you know, at no, and he's, that kid, I think, had a growth spurt between the pilot and later.
I wouldn't surprise me.
To the point that, well, because it so long went between, like.
Absolutely.
To the point that I'm a little surprised they didn't replace him between those episodes, because they did replace someone else. But even so, he's Travis's quite a lot younger brother. Like, Javi's not in high school. So
no, I think he's supposed to be junior high-ish.
At most, yeah. I mean, the actor is about 13 now. So I would think that, you know, that's a little kid. You'd feel kind of protective, and Shauna certainly did.
Yeah, and it seems so like they kind of all did.
It feels to me like they would go looking for Javi if he were alive, and they must know he's not.
Or theoretically, he could have been rescued and then subsequently passed, or, you know,
changed his name as Travis did.
Left contact in some way, moved to another part of the world. Like, he's just isn't part of the universe anymore.
If he walked far enough that night and found something and got rescued, which I suppose is possible because we don't see him again.
Yeah.
It's possible they don't know what happened to him and assume he froze out in the wilderness.
Oh, well, that's an interesting idea. I hadn't thought about this as much, but the idea that the party could be splintered and some number of them who were rescued at the 19th month mark, they think they are all that made it, but somebody else could have made it as well and just hasn't rejoined the story until 2021.
Yeah, we only see probably 3 or so months, like,
yeah,
because Shauna is just starting to show at Doom Coming.
Yeah,
we know earlier, although we're not told exactly how long goes on, we know earlier in episode 5 titled Blood Hive, when all the girls have their periods that have synced up, which is not exactly a thing. Women know.
Oh boy.
It can seem to happen, but the idea that if after they've been there a month, this is apparently the first period they're all having, that it would already have synced.
That's the thing that made it seem like it had been 6 months.
Maybe it had been longer, but Shauna has
timelines all over the place.
Before that said, I got the impression she knew why her period was late. It may not even be the first one she's missed. I think it's at least the second one she's missed, and now she knows she's pregnant.
Yep.
Either that or she took a pregnancy test shortly before leaving because
my
certainly
sense was
hasn't taken one in the wilderness.
She was figuring it out in real time in that episode. Yeah. It's like, oh no.
Yeah. So it's possibly it's the first one she's missed, but she definitely knows why.
Yeah.
But that also means if that's the first one she's missed, she's about a month or so along, give or take. Yeah. Right. I mean, the way pregnancies are dated and the way ovulation and periods actually work, it may not be quite that long. Like, you could be 2 weeks along. You ovulate about 2 weeks before your period. So, and theoretically, but I feel like they've been there more than 2 weeks at that point because they've already walked him down the cabin.
It's really hard to say. Yeah.
Who knows? But there's one of the creators is a woman. Theoretically, she knows this. So, let's say she's, I don't know, 6 weeks or so along at that point and is missing her second period. And now she knows, like, it's late. She knows why it's late. She definitely figures out why it's late. Like, we see her sort of discover the breast tenderness and put this together. Mm-hmm. And so it's.
I don't know if we're ever going to get like a full, you know, description of like, okay, here are all the episodes and here are the dates that the days take place on. I don't know if they're ever going to give us a canon timeline, but I don't mind it being a little loosey-goosey, a little fuzzy.
I actually wonder if it's ambiguous because we're not allowed to know because they don't know.
That's the thing, is I think they're trying to keep their options open a little bit.
Oh, I meant that the characters don't know.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, so they want us, the audience, to be in their shoes a little bit.
You're out there for 19 months. Do you have a calendar?
Like, they know the seasons.
Before people wandered around with cell phones, before they Mm-hmm. Like, we have not seen anyone. There are a couple of people with journals, but we don't necessarily see that anyone's writing every day. Like, does anyone really know for sure what day it is anymore?
Yeah, they're not doing the other like Castaway type trope where you mark a notch on the wall.
Exactly. So I wonder if it's that, you know, we're not told feel on board where we are in the timeline because they don't know quite when things happened. They know things like, well, Javi went missing the same night that Jackie died. And that was the first time it really snowed.
Yeah. So first snow is a date.
Was that November? Yeah. I don't know. So yeah, I wonder. I just wonder like how much we're sticking to a timeline and how much we might even be jumping around that maybe things didn't happen exactly in the order that we're seeing them.
So you're talking about like an unreliable narration sort of tactic. I mean, that's an interesting idea as well.
Yeah. I don't know, but I wonder about that. I do. My question for you.
Oh.
What do we think happened with Shauna's baby?
That was on my list and I didn't ask it. My presumption is that something goes wrong with the pregnancy just because statistically, like, I mean, you know this, so I'll just say this for the benefit of listeners who may not, but like pregnancy was a leading cause of death for women before the modern era. Like the reason that you have a lot of stories with like adventures with kids when like their mom isn't around is because it was really common for women to die in childbirth.
But we know Shauna doesn't.
We know Shauna doesn't. But my point by bringing up that is just the idea of statistics is giving birth unaided by modern medical science is incredibly dangerous to both the child and the mother. And so the idea that she could somehow spontaneously terminate, you know, from poor nutrition, that's not crazy to me. I feel like it's unlikely that the show would have her give birth and then the baby die.
I mean, I hope not, but also there's no indication, like her daughter's not old enough.
Oh no, it's definitely not Callie.
It's not Callie.
It 100% is not, yeah.
Was this other kid ever born or not? I mean, for both their sakes out in the wilderness, I hope not. because and that's also a terrible way to be raising a baby.
Yeah, and also because like, then the show kind of, like that becomes a big part of that character. And a lot of people criticized Teen Natalie's storyline where she was more interesting in sort of the first part of the series and then became like so attached to Travis and the romance. I saw a lot of feedback on Twitter of like not appreciating that she went from like more interesting to less interesting in the eyes of these people who I'm not going to specifically call out because don't need to.
No, but it's, I mean, I think that's interesting that they consider that less interesting. It's, I mean, I think knowing what we know about Natalie.
The storyline just narrowed, you know, she wasn't doing as many different things.
Really what I mean. But she and Travis are the only two who can handle the gun properly. So they end up being forced together.
Yeah, absolutely.
On top of which, Travis has very recently lost his dad in this very violent crash. Absolutely, and Natalie lost hers not that long ago to an accident with a gun. It's not surprising to me that they would trauma bond and then on top of that bond over being maybe the only two people there who know what it is to lose a parent. And specifically their dad.
Yeah.
And their dad, who wasn't great in both their cases. They did not have great father figures, apparently.
Certainly seems that way.
And didn't have great relationships, but nonetheless, that was their father.
And that wasn't the complaint that the relationship was unrealistic. The complaint was that so many of Natalie's scenes were about Travis.
Yeah.
That her focus as a character wasn't also doing things with the other girls. That was the complaint.
Interesting.
So
That's interesting.
Yeah. I don't want teen Shauna to just become like this character's primary experience now is as a mother.
She's the teen mother. Yeah. I think it's unlikely that she will carry to term.
I think it's really unlikely that because also like, I feel like the adult versions of all these characters, like it might've come up somehow, at least by an allusion. Like they say enough things to, I appreciate how combative the relationships are sometimes. They're very sisterly in both times. And so like, it seems like something that Natalie or Misty would take Shauna about either to her face or like just about her behind her back of like, well, you couldn't even keep a baby alive, you know, just some mean bullshit thing. Like they're not above that. They're really mean to each other sometimes.
Yeah, they're definitely not above that while they're in the woods. Mm-hmm. And while they're teenagers, I would think that in adulthood, they'd be mature enough to maybe not go there. Like that,
I would think
that's a line you don't cross. But yeah, maybe not as teens. It's just, if they're going to do it, they're running out of time to do it in terms of her miscarrying. So that's why it surprised me that she made it to the end of the season and was still pregnant, because I just expected her to miscarry.
And that, I think, can still happen. And I think that's the most likely. And I think the question is, I mean, they already, the last time to get into this, but they already had a scene where they dramatized an attempted abortion.
They did, yeah.
Like, that was genuinely, like, really upsetting.
Mm-hmm. Try watching it as a woman.
I don't want to.
But on the other hand, watching it and going, this is, I mean, I wish that they had brought a bucket of water and made a little fire and sterilized the wire by boiling it for a few minutes.
Yeah.
We never see her do that.
She had like alcohol or something, like what was left of the nail polish remover or something. But yeah, very ad hoc and not the best idea.
That's, I mean, if it's nail polish remover, it's not alcohol, it's acetone. And that, to
my knowledge, not have been that. I just
does not disinfect.
Yeah. She tried, I think, is what I'm remembering.
I think your most reliable thing would have been to boil it in that environment. And
absolutely. Yeah.
And it's one of the few things they have the means to do. Mm-hmm. So I understand that they couldn't do it in front of everybody without arousing suspicions. And maybe they couldn't walk off with a bucket without arousing suspicions. I wish they had done that. But yeah, I was surprised that was not a successful attempt, that they didn't do that, because,
and so then the question is, how would you write it? Does she just get sick because of malnutrition and loses the pregnancy that way? Does she get injured? I'm not actually asking you to pitch, but there are possibilities, and I'm just curious what they will choose if they choose to go the miscarriage route.
Well, yeah, me too. It's an uncomfortable thing to talk about.
It absolutely is.
I know people
is.
Have been through it, but it's also, there is a point, and if Shauna is starting to show and she's a teenager, I would guess she's around the 4 or so month mark. Mm-hmm. There is a point where the miscarriage doesn't necessarily mean that everything comes out. And if you don't get it all out, you will go septic and die. And what I don't know how they're going to do in the woods is the D&C that would almost certainly be required if she miscarried that far along.
That's such a good point, yeah.
And that's why I'm surprised.
That's what you were talking about, timeline more. I forgot about that.
That's part of why I'm talking about timeline. We're going pretty deep into a fictional character's options, and maybe Lottie will do something magical. I don't know. And this is a terrible way to end the episode, but it just, you know, that's why then I wonder, well, did she end up having it?
And yeah, like then
it's been 25 years.
Child, did she get back with the child and then adopted it out at?
Well,
you know,
it's an
Cassie
adult
doesn't
now.
Seem to have an older sibling.
No, but she wouldn't even have had to adopt it out, because we've only met her as an adult now. That child is 25 years old.
But we've seen like family photos around the house, though, where Shauna and Jeff live. Like, there's not, there's no indication that they had another child anymore. And I'm not saying that there could or couldn't be, they could have a bad relationship with whomever that is, but with the fights they have with Cassie, it definitely seems like, well, this wasn't a problem with Johnny, or, you know, like there are plenty of opportunities to reference that. I don't know,
but there may be, if they did that, then we would know what happens.
No, of course, you're right.
So I'm just saying, and like, it's not like we've seen every room of their house and every family photo. Yeah. And you would have kids who would have a good 10-year age gap. Like, don't we find out that Callie is what, 16?
She's, yeah.
So. If you're, okay. So whenever it is in 1996, this kid would have been born in 1997 if she had it.
Yep.
So it would be approximately 24. 24. So it could, they. Sorry. Well, I don't know what gender the child is, if in fact they exist. They could be off at college, off at grad school,
or they ran away. You know,
they could,
like,
just live on
traumatic
their own.
Things happen.
Something else could have happened in between. There are all kinds of possibilities as to why they could be overseas on some sort of Greenpeace mission, like we just don't know.
Yeah.
And they're leaving that open. But I think they have not brought it up in the present day scenes, because to bring it up in any way spoils the 1996 scenes in terms of what is going to happen.
I agree with that. We'll see. I guess I'm thinking of times when, if the baby had been born and then like lived to come back to civilization, mm-hmm. it would have been weird to not talk about that person. Like, you know, some of the scenes. Yeah, I mean, you and I both have siblings. Like there are mm-hmm. natural times when references to another sure. sibling come up when parents are talking to a child. And mm-hmm. so I think of some of those scenes with the daughter, and like it's if there is an adult older sibling for mm-hmm. Cassie, it's weird that person didn't come up during like the divorce conversation or, you know, her college fund. Like there are plenty of times when it would seem natural. And again, this is just entirely my reaction to things. I'm not saying the show is doing anything.
There are places where you could work it in. Like there's about $12,000 in your college fund, and that sounds really sad, but we already sent your brother. Yes, you could write that line.
Exactly.
But you don't need to.
I agree with both sides of that. So it works with and without.
Yeah. And I think I will say this, I will pitch, if she does have the baby and it grows up, I think it's a boy.
Okay, interesting. What makes you?
Because they keep saying things like, our daughter is awful. Which leads me to think she's their only daughter.
That absolutely sells me. I'm done.
Because otherwise, which one are you referring to?
Yeah.
I mean, the one you just had the conversation with who, you know, uh-huh. was snarky. Like, she is kind of a terrible teenager, but
I'm sure
she's no more terrible than any other bratty teenager.
I'm sure that parents with multiple children of the same gender would still phrase things that way from time to time, but I agree with what you're saying in the context of dialogue. Like that's mm-hmm. a specific dialogue choice.
I'm just putting that on record for if we find out that, like, I'm going on record saying I suggest that if she has this child, it's a boy.
I will co-sign that. And let's
so we're obviously not going to do a wager because
we're on the same side. Okay. I think you're correct. That makes sense to me. That feels right, mm-hmm. if you will. So let's just say Ashley Lyle and Bart Nickerson, creators and writers, if you're
listening to this.
And if you haven't made up your mind about this.
I don't think anyone's listening to this 3-hour episode at this point.
Well, props to everybody involved in the show because it fucking mm-hmm. rules. It's definitely... like we are new in this year, but it is mm-hmm. one of the best things that I've seen so far in a year filled with, frankly, some very, very compelling TV.
Yeah, it's super well done. I think in particular, its target audience is probably young Gen X, mid Gen X in a lot of ways. Like if you were a teenager in the 90s, you will identify.
Yeah.
I think it's maybe not so much aimed at people older.
Perhaps.
Or, you know, it ain't for the boomers, is my guess.
I'm okay with that.
And it may not be for Gen Z, but for sure. I knew these girls when I was in high school. Like, I recognized them. I recognized their clothes and their haircuts and the way they talk and what they do. And it is.
These would have been the older sisters of my friends who had older sisters.
Oh, probably. Yeah. Yeah. But it was wild to me when I did the math on like a 1996 and, you know, they're 17, 18, whatever. It's like, oh, yep, that's mm-hmm. that's when I was 18. I turned 18 in 96. So.
I did that math also.
Yeah, this is my exact era. Yeah.
This show was made just for you.
Well, I think it is definitely well past time to wrap this up. So, Chris, what would you like to plug?
I'm going to plug midnight because it's almost midnight.
It is not.
It has been days and days we've been having this podcast. As we are in March, I don't have anything special to plug. So Christopher, say hi on Twitter, Chris M. Royce. That's it for now. What do you want to tell the folks about?
At Stevie KJ on Insta and Twitter. Go watch Honestly Charlotte, which you can do either at honestlycharlotte.com or just go to YouTube and type in Honestly Charlotte and it'll come up. If you enjoy script readings, there will be one March 14th. The Cold Reading Series is on. We are still on Zoom, so wherever you are in the world, You can come and join us. And I think I'm giving you enough lead time because this episode will drop the week before. So March 14th, 7 p.m. Pacific time, you can tune in. We will be doing a script reading of a yet to be announced new script.
Ooh, with, exciting.
Professional actors, but it's a cold read, meaning they get the script half an hour before the event starts and do their best with it. We feature new work mostly by writers local to Vancouver, but we do accept stuff from outside as well. It is free to attend. You just have to register at coldreadingseries.com. Please feel free to come and join us.
It's a fun show. I saw one of them. It was good.
You did. Yeah. And I'm one of the co-producers, so I will be there.
Ta-da.
If that's any kind of draw for you, I understand. If it's
maybe you feel like you've had enough after this podcast.
Good Lord, I've had enough of me after this podcast.
If you haven't, follow us on Twitter at BudsWOBoards. Go to buddieswithoutborders.tumblr.com for show notes and more. Thank you if you're still listening. Thank you if you're subscribed.
I'm impressed with you if you're still listening. Yeah, we have not updated that Tumblr in a while.
Yeah, we'll get to it.
We'll get to it.
Thanks for listening and rating and reviewing. And I derailed from my pitch. I guess we're done. Cue the music.
We're sorry.
No, we can't end on we're sorry.
We absolutely can.
I'm not sorry.
I have more notes. Everybody.
We're going to... All right, we're done for now. Talk to you next time.